Let's take a closer look at these compact sets, gamma of XL from the last curling episode. We're going to introduce a closely related additional family of compact sets called sigma L. So they're going to be sigmas and gammas. We'll discuss the basic properties of the gammas and sigmas, and we'll define other families, not just the ones from a half hour ago, but other families that have the same basic properties, and we'll find that the study of such gammas and sigmas is fundamental in proving all the results in all the lectures, just except for the classic extension theorem. Okay, so the goal in this talk is to get acquainted with gammas and sigmas, and then in the next talk, we'll apply what we've learned in order to prove the main theorem from a half hour ago, namely that gamma sub L star for a suitable integer constant L star is contained in the true gamma. And remember that a half hour ago we decided that all of our results about CM interpolation of functions defined on finite subsets of Rn reduce to that. Okay, so today we find out, we get to know gammas and sigmas, and then tomorrow we use them. Okay. Now I'm going to generalize the setting that we've seen so far. So we fix our integers as usual, and we work at Cm of Rn as usual. Jx of f denotes the m minus first degree Taylor polynomial of f at x as usual. Script p is the vector space of all such as usual. But, so we're given our finite set E as usual, a function f on E as usual, m is greater than 0. So far, we've tried to find functions that agree exactly with f. But now we're going to broaden the discussion by introducing a tolerance. We're going to look for functions that agree approximately with the given f. So we're given now a capital E and f as usual, and a capital M as usual, but also this function epsilon. Epsilon is supposed to take values that are greater than or equal to 0, and we're looking for a function capital F in Cm of Rn whose norm is at most capital M and which agrees approximately with little f on the set E, in the sense that if you take any particular point x in E, the difference between capital F and little f at that point is at most m times epsilon of x. So, for example, if you set epsilon identically equal to 0, then that reduces to the previous problem in which we want to interpolate perfectly. It might be a little strange to think that the m sits in front of the factor epsilon of x. Think of an experimenter measuring some function with error bars. But of course, no one tells you what epsilon of x is, and if you like, you can take the epsilon that you really want and divide it by m, and then the m will disappear. So the goal is to try to find capital Fs that satisfy the conditions in the box. Okay, and so that's a more general set. Now, corresponding to that more general problem, there are true gammas and sigmas. So, well, I haven't talked about any sigmas yet, but here's the true gamma and its close relative to true sigma. So suppose that x is in Rn, maybe x is in E, maybe not. Actually, for most of these lectures, x will be in E, but it doesn't have to. It doesn't have to be. All right, so gamma of xn is the set of all jets x of functions capital F that do what we want, namely capital F is in Cm, its norm is at most capital M, and at each point of E, it differs from the given little f by at most m times epsilon of x, as on the slide. That's the definition of the true gamma. And again, if you think that epsilon of x is identically 0, then you get the true gamma from the previous lectures. All right, now, an interesting special case arises if you try to fit the function 0, and you declare that capital M is equal to 1. And in that case, you arrive at the set of all jets at x of Cm functions of norm at most 1, which have the property that on E they are less than or equal to epsilon of x.
In their first box, Yes. You are using x in two different meanings.
Oh, you are right. You were right. Okay,
sure,
I'm sorry.
I just wanted to make sure that the second time it is another y.
Oh, yes, the second time. So wherever, yes. Inside this, oh my God, thank you. Inside the curly brackets, the only x that should appear is the j sub x of f.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oops. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the same in the...
And the same in the signal. Yeah, sorry. So these are the most fundamental objects, and so getting the definition wrong is not such a good idea. Okay. All right. Alright, so gamma of xm is a possibly empty convex subset of script P, and it's determined by xef epsilon of m. Sigma, on the other hand, is a symmetric convex set. We're trying to fit the function 0. If you look at these conditions, with your imagination, erase some of the x's and replace them by y's. These conditions are obviously symmetric under replacing. Changing g to minus g, and so sigma is a symmetric convex set, and in particular, it is not possibly empty, at least contains zero. Okay, so we have the true gamma and the true sigma, and these sets contain a lot of information about interpolation. For example, by obviously immediately from the definition, the interpolation problem in the box has a solution, if and only if the gamma is not empty. Because gamma is the set of blah, blah, blah that arise from interpolants that satisfy the condition in the red box. Okay. So already if we ask whether gamma is empty, that tells us interesting information. Remember, our interpolation problems are delicate. If E lies near the zero set of one polynomial or several polynomials, P1 through PL, the convex set sigma of x encodes those polynomials. Let's look at an example. So let's say we're working in C3 of the plane. Let's look at the set E. The set E consists of all the red dots, and the red dots all lie on the parabola x1 squared equals x2. Well, and let's pick out one point, which we call x0. That's one of the red dots. What does sigma of x0 look like? It is the set, and let's say epsilon is identical to 0. I didn't say that, but let's say epsilon is identical to 0. Alright, then we look at functions that vanish at all the red dots and have C3 norm at most 1. What can the second degree Taylor polynomial look like at the red dot x0? Well, it could certainly be a nice healthy multiple of the polynomial x1 squared minus x2. But it better not be anything else. In some transverse direction in the space of polynomials, the fact that the function vanishes at all these red dots is going to constrain highly how big the polynomial is. Okay? And so the set sigma of x0 is indicated schematically in green. Okay. So the moral of the story is that the polynomials of zero sets may make trouble for us if doing interpolation problems are precisely the directions in the vector space script P in which the convex symmetric set sigma of x is long. So we're going to be taking advantage of that. Okay, back to the general case. We want to compute the approximate size and shape of the true gamma and the true sigma, which now by fortunate coincidence are written correctly on this slide. Okay, we want to approximate those. And so, as in the last, as in today's first lecture, we're going to define convex sets gamma L and sigma L by induction on L, and we're going to prove a main theorem which asserts that the true gammas and the gamma L star for a certain constant L star are related by the inclusions shown on the slide, so that if you don't distinguish between N and CN, then basically gamma L star and gamma are the same. And so in that sense, we've computed the approximate size and shape of the true gamma. Now, our gamma L and sigma L will contain the true gamma, but decrease with L, or with sigma and decrease with L, as shown on the slide, just as last time. Okay, let's do it. So here's the induction on L. It's going to look very familiar. In the base case, L equals zero. Here's the definition of gamma zero and the definition of sigma zero. And as you can see, gamma zero and sigma zero consist of all polynomials P or Q that do what they are supposed to, simply observing the single point x and paying no attention to any other point of E. So it is obvious that the gamma zero contains the true gamma, and the sigma zero contains the true sigma. But they are probably much too big. And again, these are written correctly. All these x's actually should be x's. Okay, the induction step is exactly as before. Fix L, fix M. Suppose we've defined the gammas and sigmas for all x in E. I'm going to define the gamma L plus 1 and sigma L plus 1 for all x in E. And here's the definition. Gamma L plus 1 of Xm consists of all P in gamma L of Xm, such that for each Y in E, there is a P prime in the gamma L of Ym, such that the usual Taylor estimate holds. And similarly, sigma L plus 1 of X is going to consist of all Q and sigma L of X, such that for each Y in E, there exists a Q prime in sigma L of Y, such that a Taylor estimate holds. Okay. In the upper box, there's a capital M because gammas refer to are intended to study interpolants whose norm is at most M. In the lower box, there is no factor of M because the sigma is intended to study CM functions whose norms are at most 1. Okay, so this formula, this slide is conceivably actually correct. Okay. So compared to the gamma L defined a half hour ago for the case epsilon identically zero, our gamma zero has been modified, but the induction step passing from gamma L to gamma L plus 1 is exactly the same. And the sigma L, which didn't appear last time, is completely analogous to the gamma L. Okay, so those are the sigma L and the gamma L. As in the previous lecture, an easy induction on L shows the following simple properties. So first of all, each gamma L is a possibly empty convex set. Each sigma L is a symmetric convex set. The gamma L contains the true gamma. The sigma L contains the true sigma. The gamma L's decrease with L, and the sigma L's similarly decrease with L. And those are obvious just as they were last time. Okay. All right, so our goal is to prove the theorem that gamma L star of Xm is contained in the true gamma of X sigma m, where L star, Cm, where L star and C depend only on little m in our space Cm of Rn. And so that will generalize the main theorem from last time, because we're no longer restricted to the case that epsilon is identical to zero. Okay. And so all of the theorems from the previous lecture are reduced to a theorem on gammas, which is going to be a special case of today's main theorem asserted for the gammas to be proved next time. Okay, so in order to prepare the way, let me discuss just the basic properties of the gammas and sigmas. And so let's first look at the true gamma and sigma. Okay. So I just want to make a few simple observations. First of all, suppose we have two polynomials, both belonging to gamma. Let's say one of them belongs to gamma of xm1, and the other one belongs to gamma of xm2. If we subtract them, then the difference is easily seen to belong to m1 plus m2 times the sigma. Because if you subtract two functions, both of which approximate little f on E, their difference approximates zero on E. And if one of them has C1 norm at most M1, and the other one has Cm norm at most M2, when you subtract them, it has Cm norm at most M1 plus M2. So that's a trivial observation. Similarly, if, like say conversely, if P is in gamma of X for some particular M, let's say M1, and Q is in a multiple of the sigma, let's say M2, then when you add Q to P, you find yourself in gamma of X, M1 plus M2, and that's a simple verification that follows immediately from the definitions. Okay? So these are immediate consequences of the definitions, and therefore we have the following conclusion, inclusions. So suppose that P was in gamma of Xm, then if you look at a translative N sigma by P, that's contained in gamma of X2m, which in turn is contained in a translate by P of sigma of X multiplied by 3m. So roughly speaking, if gamma of Xm is not empty so that there is some P in gamma of Xm, then gamma of Xm is essentially a translate of M times sigma. Here the point of view is that I'm not particularly distinguishing between M and 2M and 3M because I'm only going to succeed in calculating orders of magnitude of things anyway. Okay? So in particular, if gamma of Xm is sort of a translate of M times sigma of X, then sigma of X tells us how much room to maneuver there is inside gamma of Xm. Okay? Onward. Okay. Now, we've worked with the true gamma and sigma, but analogous properties hold also for the gamma L and sigma L by some easy induction. Okay. And so now I'd like to describe all the key properties that we're going to use of the gammas and sigmas, and we've seen almost all of them already. Okay, so here's the first one. I'm going to call it zero sub gamma. So gamma L is a possibly empty convex subset of the space script P of Taylor polynomials. And furthermore, if I make the M bigger, the gamma gets bigger. And also, any P in gamma L satisfies the condition that its derivatives. So those conditions are clear, I think. Okay, here's the analogous property for the sigma. Sigma L of X is a symmetric convex set, and any Q in sigma of L has its derivatives less than or equal to 1. Again, that's obvious. Okay. Here's another property. This is how the gammas are related to the sigmas. So if P is in gamma L of Xm, then we'll look at the inclusions and accept the fact that C1 is used to be equal to 2 and C2 used to be equal to 3. This is what we just proved. Okay. So we've just discussed property 1 and properties 0 are obvious. So far this little laundry list of conditions is in good shape. Notice that there are two constants here, C1 and C2. They will reappear in a moment. Okay. Here are other properties of gamma and sigma. So let's look at the upper box. So we fix an L, and we suppose that P is in gamma L of Xm. Well, then given any y, give E, there is a P prime in gamma L minus 1 of YE, so we have lost. We have lost one from the L. But with the P prime and the P are close together in the sense of the Taylor estimate. There it is in the upper box. That just restates the definition of gamma L in terms of gamma L minus 1 by induction. Right? P in gamma L, P belongs to gamma L if and only if this condition 2 sub gamma holds. So that's why 2 gamma is true. And the analogous property for the sigma appears below. Okay, if Q belongs to the sigma at X, to sigma L, then given in Y, there exists a Q prime in sigma L minus 1 of Y, for which the Taylor estimate holds. And again, there's no factor M because sigmas have to do with CM1 rather than CM1. And so these statements simply restate the definitions of the gammas and sigmas by induction. Okay? All right. Now there's one more crucial property of the sigmas. And here it is. So suppose that I have suppose that I have P in sigma L, and I have any other polynomial Q, and I have the length scale delta, some positive number less than 1. And suppose that P and Q satisfy the estimates that you see on the slide. Then it follows that the jet product of P and Q, that is the jet of their ordinary product as polynomials, belongs to some multiple CW of the sigma. So this CW depends only on little m, little n, and L. And I'm going to coin a phrase. I'm going to say that sigma L is Whitney T convex at x with Whitney constant CW, and that indicates this property in the box. Okay. So I've stated it, but I haven't proven it. And so I'd like to discuss it a little and then prove it. But this is an important property. Okay, is it clear what the property says? So you can take things in sigma L, and sometimes you can multiply them by anything else, and that will belong to a multiple of CL, provided that's an estimate. What a good question. What is T? T turns out to be a modulus of continuity, the modulus of continuity of Lipschitz functions. So later T will be replaced by other things. Okay, but for the moment, it's just a phrase, Whitney T convex. Often when I lecture on this, I forget to say T, but here I have slides, so the probability of getting it right is increased. Okay, so this is the extra condition. Now, all right, let me just observe that the estimates on P and Q look familiar from Whitney's 1934 proof of the Whitney extension theorem. Remember there, a big idea was to write a function f as a sum, as shown on the slide. These fq's are, in Whitney's proof, polynomials associated to points that are near the q or q hat. And if you remember, the estimates that we are now assuming for P, take a look at them. The estimates we're now assuming for P used to be satisfied by the difference of local functions associated to two adjacent Whitney cubes. And if you look at the estimates that are now being assumed for Q, those were the estimates from Whitney's theorem on the partition unity theta Q, and this number delta less than or equal to 1 was the side length of Whitney Q in Whitney's argument. So these estimates look very familiar. Okay? And so if you assume those estimates, then you can go ahead and multiply P by Q, and you don't leave sigma. Okay. That's nice. So the estimates look somehow familiar. Why is this assertion true? Well, this is an assertion about sigma L. Let me instead prove or sketch the proof of a corresponding assertion about the true sigma. And these sigma L's are defined as an approximation to the true sigma. And I will ask you just to believe that similar ideas will work there. So, I'm going to prove 3 sigma, that is the Whitney T convexity for the true sigma, and then let's just believe that Whitney T convexity is true by similar reasoning, but with an extra little induction on L for the sigma lens. Okay, so we may as well suppose that our point X is the origin. So let's say P is in sigma 0, Q is some polynomial, delta is a number less than or equal to 1, and I'm assuming the estimates from condition 3. Assuming these estimates that the derivative, the alpha derivative of P at the origin is at most delta to the m minus alpha, while the alpha derivative of Q is at most delta to the minus alpha, and that holds for all alpha up to the degree of these polynomials named m minus square. Okay, we're assuming that, and we want to see what happens if we multiply P and Q together. Well, because P is in sigma 0, by definition, there is a CM function G, whose norm is at most 1, and whose absolute value is less than or equal to epsilon everywhere in E, and whose jet at G, I'm sorry, and whose jet at the origin is P. That's the definition of sigma 0. So there exists such a G. Okay? All right. Now let's take the smooth cutoff function theta, satisfying the conditions in the box. So theta is going to be 1 in the neighborhood of the origin, but it's going to be 0 if we're further from the origin, if we're farther from the origin than delta. And it's going to be as smooth as possible so that every time you differentiate, you lose a factor of delta as on the slide. Okay? So we fix such a cutoff function that lives in a ball of radius delta around the origin. Okay? And now, if you look at our estimates for p, q, g, and theta, those estimates will imply good things about the function g tilde, which is theta times pq. It satisfies the conditions in the box. Namely, you can bound its CM norm. Furthermore, it's less than or equal to a constant times epsilon of x for all x in E. And furthermore, its jet at the origin is pq. Therefore, the jet at the origin of the jet at the origin agrees with the jet of pq. It's the jet product of p with q. And so therefore, the jet at the origin of pq belongs to a constant multiple of sigma, this constant c being the same c that appears in the red box. And so that's the proof of property 3 for the true sigma. Okay, simple as that. I hope that's plausible. Okay, and so let's just remove 3 sigma from the sigma L. One more property, namely, remember the gamma L contained the true gamma, which means the property in the box here labeled exclamation mark. So, given a function f and cn, given an m, if we suppose that the norm is at most m, and if capital F agrees with the data as shown, then it follows that the jet belongs to gamma L of xn for all x in E. And that simply means that the gamma L contain the true gamma. Okay? That's it. The basic properties of the gamma L and sigma L are the ones just mentioned, which have these funny labels. Recall that two constants called C1 and C2 enter into property 1. That's the one saying that the gamma is approximately a translation of the sigma, of m times the sigma. And there's a constant CW, the Whitney constant, that enters into condition 3, the Whitney T convexity. So there are these three constants floating around. Okay, now, these are the only properties that we will ever use regarding gamma L and sigma L, and so we're ready to state the main result. So here's the main theorem. So fix a large enough constant L star depending only on M and N, and then the following holds. Suppose that gamma L and sigma L are not necessarily the guys we just defined, but anything that satisfy all the properties that you see there in the laundry list with constants C1, C2, and CW. Well, then given any polynomial P0 in L star of, let's say, X0, M0, there is a function capital F in CM of Rn whose norm is at most multiple of M0 is on the slide, and whose jet at every point x in E belongs to the gamma 0 as on the slide, and whose jet at the particular point x0 is equal to p0. Now the constant C that appears in the box there depends only on little m and little n, the usual fellows, and on these three constants C1, C2, and CW. Okay? And so this main theorem is true not merely for the gammas and sigmas that I told you about before, but for any gammas and sigmas with those properties. As a corollary, we find that the true gammas in the setting of our tolerance that is contained, well, there's the corollary. The gamma L star is essentially the true gamma. The precise statement is written on the slide. And so we have succeeded in computing the approximate size and shape of the gammas. So today's main theorem on the gammas implies the main theorem from whatever it is an hour ago on those gammas. It's more general because we're no longer restricted to epsilon as identically zero. And so today's main theorem gives us all the results from the previous lecture, but in a more general form involving epsilons. for the moment, in fact, for all 10 lectures, I'm not going to state those generalizations, but instead I want to explore the implications of the fact that today's mean theorem holds for any family of gammas and sigmas satisfying the laundry list of properties, not merely for the ones I defined before. Why should I make such a fuss about that? So to start with, I'd like to sketch two very different ways to define other families of gammas and sigmas that satisfy the same properties and explain why we care. Okay? So for the first alternative family of gammas and sigmas, let's return to the Ruby-Schwarzman finiteness principle. So remember, here's the statement of the theorem with slightly different notation. Fix m and n greater than or equal to 1. There is a finiteness constant called k sharp in it, and a real constant called now c sharp that depend only on m and n, for which the following holds. Take a function to the left, take define on a finite set E, let's say m is positive. Suppose that for every finite subset S in E with at most k sharp elements, there is an extension of little f from S to Cm with norm at most m. Then there is an extension of f from the whole set E with norm at most C sharp. And that's, remember, that's the Ruby-Schwarzman finiteness theorem. Now, all right, we know fancier versions. We can just look at a list of particular subsets, not every set. We don't need to consider every little subset. We have variants with epsilons. Never mind all that. Let's just see how we can think about this finiteness theorem. Okay, there. So that's the, that's the plain English explanation of what the Ruby-Schwarzman finiteness theorem says. That says we don't, right, that says there's the refined version. Let's not worry about that. Now, all right, what I'm going to do is show you that there's a suitable family of gammas and sigmas that satisfy a laundry list of properties. Let's take epsilon equals 0, I'm going to handle the more general case, let's not bother. In such a way that today's main theorem about the gammas and sigmas will yield the original Ruby-Schwarzman finiteness. So I'm about to define a new family of gammas and sigmas. So starting off, let's associate a gamma with a point x of E, a positive number m, and a subset s contained in E. And there's the definition of a gamma. Gamma of x and s is the set of all jets at x of functions in Cm of norm at most capital M that agree with little f on s. Okay. And down below is the analogous definition of a sigma. Okay. Notice that if I make s bigger, I make gamma and sigma smaller. Take a look at the definition. It's obvious. If I throw in more points to s, there are fewer functions capital F that get the job. Okay. All right. Now, let D be the dimension of this space of Taylor polynomials script P. And I'm now going to define gamma L and sigma L. And gamma L at xm is going to be the intersection of gamma of xms over all subsets s contained in E, containing at most a certain number of elements, and that certain number of elements happens to be d plus 1 to the L for reasons that will be clear very soon. Okay? And similarly for the sigma. So we're intersecting a lot of gamma xms together to produce gamma L x m. Okay. Now these gammas and sigmas satisfy the whole laundry list of properties just described. Furthermore, right, we're interested in whether gamma L star is non-empty, and gamma L star is guaranteed to be non-empty, provided that this finiteness constant K sharp in the Ruby-Schwarzman finiteness theorem is bigger than or equal to D plus 1, remember D is the dimension of the space of Taylor polynomials, D plus 1 to the power L star plus 1. And so for a particularly large K-sharp determined by the L star, if you have the hypothesis of the Ruby-Schwarzman finiteness theorem, it tells you that a gamma L star is non-empty, which is the main hypothesis of the second sequence. Okay, so therefore, the Ruby-Schwarzschild finiteness theorem follows at once from today's main theorem applied to the new gammas and sigmas that I just defined. Okay, by the way, a little historical note, what I call the new gammas and sigmas were actually defined a couple of years before the gammas and sigmas that I talked about in the last lecture, so new is a strange word in this context. Okay, anyway, the definition of the gammas and sigmas and the proofs of all the properties are based on a very simple, lovely basic theorem about convex sets, Helly's theorem. Suppose I have finitely many convex subsets in RD. Suppose that any d plus one of them have a point in common. Then they all have a point in common. That's Helly's theorem. I don't have time to prove Helly's theorem for you. There's a very simple elegant proof, which you can find by googling Helly's theorem and clicking on the Wikipedia entry. So it's a few lines long, very lovely. Okay, so let's use Helly's theorem to check that the hypotheses of the finiteness theorem imply that the gamma L star is not empty. Okay. By definition, gamma L star is the intersection of a whole lot of gamma of X and S, in particular over all S with at most a certain number of elements as shown in the slide. Okay? Now, we want to show that this intersection is non-empty. By Helly's theorem, it's enough to show that any D plus one of them have a point in common. So it's enough to show that gamma of X, M, S1 intersect, dot, 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 intersect, gamma of X, M, S, D plus 1 is not empty whenever S1 through SD plus 1 are subsets of E, each containing at most D plus 1 to the L star elements. Okay? It's enough to prove that. However, we can just take the union of those S1 through SD plus 1, call that S. Guess what? It has at most d plus 1 to the L star plus 1 elements. And that's less than or equal to k sharp, as we assumed. So, we can apply the hypotheses of the finiteness theorem to that particular S. The S has at most k sharp elements, and so there is at least some function fs with the property that it has norm at most m, and it agrees with little f on s, which is the union of all those little guys, s1 through sd plus 1. So by definition, jx of the j at x of fs belongs to gamma of xms, and so gamma of xms is not empty. However, remember that as you make the set s bigger, the gamma gets smaller. The set S contains S1 through SD plus 1, and therefore the gamma of XMS is contained in gamma of XMS1 and gamma of XMS2 and etc. gamma of XMD plus 1. And so their intersection is not empty because it contains gamma of XMS, which is not empty. That completes the proof that gamma L star is not empty. That means that the original Bruni-Schwarzschild finiteness theorem follows from today's main theorem about gammas and sigmas. Of course, I haven't begun to prove to you today's main theorem about gammas and sigmas. Okay, so much for the above gammas and sigmas. There is yet another family of gammas and sigmas. I don't have time to define them, but I will motivate them and say a little tiny bit about them. Okay? Remember, we want to make efficient computations to find interpolants. And although I've given, I think, a lot of emphasis to what can be computed in the statements of the theorems, when I explain the ideas of a proof, of all the proofs, I'm giving short shrift to many computational algorithmic ideas. But we want to compute some capital F using at most n log n one-time work and at most log n query work. In order to do that, if we want to use the gammas and sigmas, we had better compute the gammas and sigmas in O of n log n one-time work. Okay, how on earth are we going to do that? Well, so let me just stop for a minute. Is it clear we had better compute our gammas and sigmas in O of n log n one time work in order to have a chance of computing determinants as efficiently as advertised. Okay. Now, gammas and sigmas are convex sets. Well, here was the definition of a gamma. Let's not worry about the sigma for a moment. Remember that in this definition, to decide whether P lies in gamma L plus 1 of X, we have to examine every Y and look for a P prime in gamma L of Y. So every Y in E talks to every X in E. That's the point of the slide. Every Y in E talks to every X in E. Now, the relevant objects that we're looking for are convex subsets of script P. Those can be very complicated objects. Let's pretend that instead of dealing with convex sets, we're just dealing with numbers. That's going to make life much easier, unrealistically easier. Nevertheless, the mere fact that every Y talks to every X means that the calculation of the gammas is going to take n squared work, because every X has to listen to every Y. All right. And so in the best of all possible worlds in which a convex set would be stored in one memory cell and manipulated in one computer operation, we're not going to do better than n squared work. Oh, dear Lord. We have got to reduce that from n squared to n log n. Okay. Well, here we've used the gammas and sigmas from the last lecture. Let's try some different gammas and sigmas. Well, I just defined new gammas and sigmas using subsets S. But that's even worse. It's much, much worse, because the number of subsets S contained in E with at most that number of elements is at most that power of N. That's a whole lot worse than N squared. So we're in very bad shape. And so in order to make efficient computations, we have to define yet another family of gammas and sigmas based on the well-separated pairs decomposition. The construction of those gammas and sigmas is not so simple, and so I'm just not going to give it. But I will promise you two crucial things about it. First of all, they can be computed in big O of n log n computer operations, and they satisfy our laundry list of properties. That's all I want to say about them. So that's a significant omission, but that can be done. Okay. Now I would like to explain a generalization, a significant generalization of today's main theorem. So far today's main theorem has to do with families of gammas and sigmas. Here's how we're going to generalize things. First of all, in place of Cm, we're going to work with Cm omega, the space of all Cm, the space of all functions that have n continuous derivatives and for which the nth derivatives have a modulus of continuity omega. Okay. So that's, I would say, a rather modest generalization, but when you need it, but a more interesting generalization is that instead of asking for functions f and cm that differ from little f, whose values differ from little f by at most some tolerance, instead, I'm going to ask for f in cm omega, whose jet at each point x of e belongs to a translate of a dilate of some set sigma 0 of x. So there is a convex set of jets, and I want to look for f not merely whose function values are close to assigned things, but whose jets belong to pre-assigned convex sets. Okay. And so that's a much more serious generalization. Why should we care about trusting? It will be abundantly clear in a later talk. It will be, yes, okay. So let me discuss in a little more detail each of the changes, first of all, from Cm to Cm omega, and then from merely requiring that the function values of capital F approximate those of little f, passing from that to the assertion that the jet of F belongs to a convex set. So first, the modulus of continuity. Okay, first of all, what is a modulus of continuity? I'm going to make the following assumptions on it. So omega maps the interval of all non-negative numbers into, let's say, 0, 1, with the following properties. Let's say at 0, it's 0. As t approaches 0, it approaches 0. It's increasing. It's not strictly increasing. Omega of t divided by t is decreasing, maybe not strictly decreasing. And let's say for t greater than or equal to 1, omega of t is 1. Now, those are reasonable conditions for a model of subcontinuity. Any reasonable model of subcontinuity would do that. And as an example, we could take omega of t to be the minimum of t to the alpha and 1, where alpha is between 0 and 1. Let's allow 1. Those are moduli of continuity. And so in that case, for that particular omega, Cm omega would be just Cm alpha. Okay, things with moduli of continuity of that omega are just fully continuous. Okay, so then C omega consists of all functions in Cm for which the norm that you see on the slide is finite. And so again, if omega happens to be the maximum, oh my god, there's the minimum of t to the alpha and omega, then Cm omega is just the holder of Cm alpha. Things whose nth derivatives of all the class. Okay? So, now I want to make an interesting point. Interpolation problems for Cm are actually a special case of interpolation problems for Cm omega, provided E is finite, but not at all provided E is infinite. We will discuss infinity later. Let's put that aside. But I just want to make the point that if E is finite, then, here's the explanation. Suppose I have a function defined on a finite set. Finding an interpolant with a controlled Cm norm, finding a Cm interpolant with a controlled Cm norm, is equivalent to finding an interpolant, let's say F tilde, in Cm minus 1, 1, with controlled Cm minus 1, 1 norm. In other words, the m minus first derivative should be Lipschitz, in Lipschitz 1 instead of C1. Okay? And these problems are completely equivalent. To see that, what you have to do is start with an F tilde, start with a Cm minus 1, 1 interpolant, and smooth it out just a little tiny bit and correct it just a little tiny bit. Here's an example. Here's the graph, the green line, the upper green line, is the graph of a Lipschitz function, a C01 function, that fits data points, the red data points, and the norm is impossible. Well, now, that's not a C1 function because it has a sharp corner, but we can smooth it out just a little bit, and if we smooth it out just a little bit, then maybe it doesn't quite pass through the red dots anymore, but then we correct it just a little bit. So it passes through the red dots, and we come up with a slightly nicer function, a function which is not merely Lipschitz, but in C1 with a not very big norm, and it again fits the data. And you can do the analogous thing in for Cm, for any m, but this makes crucial use of the fact that the set E is finite, because the minimum distance between two distinct points of set E determines how much you have to smooth. Okay. Now, because Cm interpolation is equivalent to Cm minus 1, comma 1 interpolation, what that means that when we pass from Cm to Cm omega, there's some slight shift. Sometimes when we think we're talking about m minus 1, we should really be talking about m. So from now on, when we work in with Cm omega, we should be dealing not with degree m minus 1 Taylor polynomials, but degree m Taylor polynomials, okay? So from now on, j of x of f is the nth degree Taylor polynomial of f and x. And from now on, script p is the vector space of all such. So that's a slight change. M minus 1 has become m, okay? And when we're dealing with Cm omega of Rn, we have to modify the definition of Whitney T convexity. The T, to answer the question, the T, Whitney T convexity, is a modulus of continuity. Okay, and instead of Whitney T convexity, we're going to have Whitney omega convexity. So suppose that sigma is a symmetric convex set, and x0 is a point, and cw is a positive real number, which is going to be a Whitney constant. And suppose that omega is a modulus of continuity, then sigma is said to be Whitney omega convex at x0 with Whitney constant cw if the following condition holds. And there it is in the box. And what you see there is that it differs from what it used to be by the presence of the omega. Okay. In the case of Whitney T convexity, omega would be T, or well, the minimum of T and 1. And then what we would have in our estimates for the derivatives of P would be delta to the power m plus 1 minus alpha. That m plus 1 agrees with what used to be the m because we've shifted m by 1. And so this is a generalization of the previous condition, and it's the natural one for discussing omega. Okay? So that's the main change there. Okay. So whenever we use Whitney T convexity before, we're now going to use Whitney omega convexity. So much for the passage from CM to CM omega. So now let's talk about the passage from interpolation problems in which we demand simply that the values of the function capital F are close to the values of little f. And let's pass from that to interpolation problems in which we demand that the jet of our interpolant should lie in a prescribed convex set. Okay, so if you look at the proof of the Rubin-Schwarzman, if you look at the proof of the Rubin-Schwarzman finiteness theorem, based on today's quote new gammas and sigmas, the ones based on subsets S, we obtain the following result, which is a generalization of the Rubin-Schwarzman finiteness theorem. So this is the generalized finiteness theorem. Let's look. So as usual, we fix M and N, and then the claim is that there exists a finiteness constant, K sharp, depending only on M and N, for which something happens. What happens? Well, suppose we're given any modulus of continuity, any finite set. For each X and E, we're given a polynomial, Px in script P, and a symmetric convex set, sigma 0 of x, sitting inside P. And we're also given positive numbers, capital M and C double. Okay, that's the setting. And now we're going to make two significant assumptions. The first one is that for each x and e, the set sigma 0 of x is Whitney omega convex at x with Whitney constant C double. The second assumption is the generalized finiteness hypothesis. So for each little subset, for each S contained in U with at most K-sharp points, there is an interpolant. There is an FS in CM omega whose norm in CM omega is at most capital M and whose jet belongs to the prescribed convex set, namely PX plus M sigma 0 of X for all X in S. So these are the hypotheses of the generalized finiteness theorem. The lower box is just the direct analog of the original finiteness hypothesis. But what you want is that the jet belongs to a convex set, rather than that the function value belongs to an interval. And the first assumption is the Whitney omega convexity. Okay. Then, under those assumptions, there exists an F in CM omega whose norm is at most a constant times M and for which the jet belongs to the prescribed convex set. The M has changed by a factor of C, and I have a misprint there. It says there that C depends only on little m, and CW. It also depends on the constants C1 and C2 that enter into the laundry list of assumptions about the gammas and sigmas. Stated because I defined the gammas and sigmas from. Never mind, I've screwed it up. It's correct as stated. Okay? Alright, so that's the generalized finiteness theorem, and it holds simply because today's main theorem uses only property, only the laundry list of properties, and those hold in this generalized setting. Okay, so what? Why go through all this? Perhaps your eyes have glazed over. Later on, when we we study CM extension of functions are defined on infinite sets E, we're going to get to a crucial point, and we're going to apply this theorem that I just described, and it will save the day. So without this, we will be out of luck, and with this, we're going to succeed in understanding infinite E. That's why I took such pains to give these very abstract-looking, rather abstract-looking generalizations of the finiteness theorem. Okay. Let's ignore that. Okay, so what's the recap? The recap is that we've described several families of gammas and sigmas that satisfy several key properties. We have stated a main theorem on families of gammas and sigmas which are assumed to satisfy those properties, and we have seen that lots of good things follow if we can prove that main theorem. Okay, and so in the next lecture, to be given bright and early tomorrow morning, we sketch the proof of today's main theorem on the gammas and sigmas. I will specialize to the case in which omega is the minimum of t and 1. So rather than the most general omega, that will avoid some boring technicalities. We've seen enough boring technicalities. I will try to keep them to a minimum. But you'll see many of the main ideas in the proof of this main theorem in that section.
Questions? Okay, I think it's been a very long morning, so let's thank Charlie again and take a break for lunch. So we're meeting here at 1:30.
And then you basically pick a element in each cluster and
that process, so you just need the clustering lemma, and the constants will depend on basically how small the clusters need to be relative to the diameter of the set. I'll check my notes. But nevertheless, it's not very. The estimates are very weak. Estimates on the norm. I'll check my notes.
And for the outliers, I don't want to stop this from playing much. I'll ask you about the outliers.
Things up, but
let's see. I gave you the yes, you have.